This is Richard Tarnas, March 13th, 2015, entitled Humanity's Rite of Passage. This was delivered at the George Center for Community. It was sponsored by Rite of Passage Journeys and Antioch University Seattle with the Jung Society.
Good evening, everyone. It's great to see this turnout to hear Rick Tarnas talk about humanity's rite of passage. But first, let me say my name's Randy Morris. I'm a core faculty member at Antioch University and also president emeritus of Rite of Passage Journeys. And this is the first event quite like this sponsored by Rite of Passage Journeys. But because it has the word rite of passage in it, it seemed highly appropriate that someone like Rick to come along and really tell us that what's happening and what we're doing with youth and adults by taking them out into the wilderness and letting them go through a rite of passage process, that we learn what the psyche needs in order to transition from one worldview to another worldview. And the psychology of how that works is the exact psychology of how it's going to work at the collective level. And as all of us who are working in that field know, we're in a huge crisis right now, a crisis of worldviews, and we need people who have been initiated into being soulful leaders for that transition. And that's what we're trying to do at Rite of Passage Journeys, taking these junior high schooler and high school kids out in the summer. And so I'd like to introduce Rick Tarnas. This is the fourth or fifth time he's been speaking either at Antioch or for the Jung Society. It's a great honor to have him in town. The whole process of trying to imagine what we need to know in order to facilitate this transition into a new worldview requires people with a very powerful prophetic imagination. And when I think about what Richard Tarnas has to offer in his writing, The Passion of the Western Mind and Cosmos and Psyche, Intimations of a New Worldview, this is precisely what we need to know. So like what's happening when we take rites of passage with youth as a microcosm of what the collective, so it is in his writing in The Passion of the Western Mind that we understand in the field of depth psychology that if you want to cure someone or if you want to heal someone, you have to understand something of their history. And what The Passion of the Western Mind teaches us, if we want to heal Western culture, we need to understand the history of ideas that shaped Western culture. And it's a very powerful book. I especially recommend the epilogue, the last 30 pages, incredible piece of work. So one of the great intellectuals of our time, personally, I believe, and as do many, I'd like to introduce Richard Tarnas.
Thank you. Very generous introduction, Randy. And I so admire the work you're doing here and the community that you've are part of and the students that I've gotten to know. Just amazing. Very a kindred spirit personally, but also kindred communities, the one that I'm more embedded in the San Francisco Bay Area and here in Seattle. Very, always feel at home when I come here. So the basic, let me just ask to get a little handle on who I'm speaking with. I know some of you, but how many of you happen to have heard me appear on other occasions that I've been here in Seattle? Oh, good, about half. And how many have, let's say, happened to read Passion of the Western Mind? Again, about half. By the way, you can read the epilogue that Randy recommended just online. You don't have to buy the whole book, although it's just a paperback, so it's not that expensive. But you can read just that epilogue by, I think, if you go to the cosmosandpsyche.com website, cosmosandpsyche.com website, under the essays page, it's right there, epilogue to The Passion of the Western Mind. Well, the basic thesis or insight that I want to share with you this evening is that most of the most distinctive features and conditions of our postmodern planetary crisis, and I'll just allude to them briefly right now, just with headlines. That sense of the deep decentering and dethroning of the established identity of the human being in this case, the widespread metaphysical spiritual sense of disorientation, the that sense of a great impending danger, both physical and spiritual, accompanied by a sense of really an encounter with mortality on a planetary scale. Let me add to that also that sense of deep uncertainty, kind of existential uncertainty, the sense of unknowingness, of not knowing the outcome of this tremendous crisis that and process that we are involved in. The intense encounter with our moral shadow, and that sense of groping in the darkness that's got a whole philosophical background of the epistemological confusion, or at the very best, radical epistemological indeterminacy that characterizes the postmodern mind. All of these characteristics, and we could unpack more, but all of those can be seen as bearing an uncanny resemblance to the rites of passage, the experiences of people, individuals who are in initiatory rites of passage, or who have experiences quite spontaneously of, say, what Stan Grof has called spiritual emergencies, perinatal death-rebirth process, near-death experiences, certain critical stages of what Jung called the individuation process, of what Joseph Campbell called the hero's journey. All of these have a kind of underlying archetypal parallelism, a template that seems to be inflected in different ways, and that what individuals are going through in those profound experiences is something that we can see happening at the collective level, except that compared with, let's say, the great tribal traditional rites of passage that were characteristic of virtually all societies that we're familiar with prior to, all the primal indigenous societies. It starts to shift after the axial era, but is certainly marginalized altogether with modernity. In those societies, those rites of passage involved a separation that occurred and a kind of placing in isolation of the individual going through the rite of passage. And it's a separation from the tribe, from the community, from the mothers, framed in different ways. But by comparison, our moment in history and the particular spiritual, ecological, philosophical, religious, social, economic, political transformation and deconstruction of the old structures that's happening in our time involves a separation not from just the local tribe or community, but from the the community of being itself from the entire ensouled cosmos, that in a sense what we might call the modern project, in some sense Western civilization itself has been driving it, what used to be called with great great pride and sort of unconsciousness of its bias, what used to be called man, modern man, etc., has in some sense, through its own intellectual, even psycho-spiritual evolution, differentiated itself out of the whole, out of the anima mundi, out of the ensouled matrix of being, the ensouled cosmos, from the earth community, and experienced itself as being separate from, superior to, eventually dissociated from, alienated from, objectifying of, and that therefore our transformative crisis involves not just this encounter with our own crisis of meaning as individuals, crisis of identity, encounter with personal danger or mortality, etc., but rather with the entire collective, the entire, in a sense, the entire Earth community has been catapulted into a catastrophic transformation. Let me give as a kind of classic example of the kind of initiatory process that I'm talking about. It's one that I happened to hear Joseph Campbell in 1970, so that's like, 35 years ago, he gave a lecture at Esalen, and in this lecture, he described a particular, it was a story, you know, he was such a great storyteller, and he told the story of a North American shamanic initiation that the explorer Rasmussen reported. He was exploring the northern part of the North American continent, and he had conversations as he was traveling and exploring. He had conversations with a number of old shamans, one of whom told him the story of his own initiation as a young boy. And he said that he was taken by an older shaman out on a sled over ice and placed in a small igloo, just big enough for him to sit in, crouched on a skin. And he was left there for 30 days, with a little water and meat being brought in to him twice during that period. And he said that he died a number of times during those 30 days, but he learned and found what can be found and learned only in the silence, away from the multitude, in the depths. He heard the voice of nature itself speak to him, and it spoke with the voice of a gentle motherly solicitude and affection. Or it sounded sometimes like children's voices, or sometimes like falling snow. And what it said was, "Do not be afraid of the universe." This discovery of a point of absolute security inside made possible his return to his community with a wisdom and an assurance that was unmatched by anyone else there, so that he could help others from that inner place, from that place of profound kind of spiritual, cosmically grounded equilibrium that he had found by going so deep inside that he had accessed the archetypal forces of life and death, of death and rebirth itself, so that he could then perceive and speak and act from that deeper place. That's, I think, a It's a very, I think, representative, initiatory experience. Let me spell out a few more ways in which, maybe I should put it this way, to unpack the ways in which the kind of postmodern situation and the those different qualities that I listed, those features, those distinctive features of our time. Let me kind of specify them a little bit more. For example, that sense of the confrontation with our moral shadow. How many different forms this is taking in our time? For example, white people recognizing in ways that, I mean, remember, we're at that moment where the Selma to Ferguson arc, which is also an arc of history that has taken us from the civil rights movement, where one was attempting, where African Americans were attempting to be able to sit on the bus, to be able to eat in the diner, to are now having a president who is African American, and little black girls are running around the White House, well, not so little anymore, as their home. Whatever else we, you know, reservations or approbations we may have about the Obama presidency, a revolution has happened that's irrevocable. A great moral development has taken place. Yet at the same time, even today, I think the white population in the United States is awakening to a new degree of awareness of the shadow of racism in our country, in the white way of being in the world. But think of it also, this encounter with the moral shadow in terms of anthropocentric bias in our way of being in the world, where one only thinks in terms of human economic progress or human dignity, for that matter. That's where all the action is, and the rest of the world is a resource, is a other form, non-human forms of life are there to be developed, exploited, objectified, owned for human benefit. And the tremendous awakening to and grieving as one takes in, and here we look at the planetary mortality encounter, where we're not just looking at our own mortality, as we all do in the course of our spiritual evolution, dark nights of the soul, but now in a way that's never, I mean, wasn't even true in World War II and the horrors of the first half of the 20th century, a whole nother thing is happening that is just unprecedented, as I don't have to tell you. The sixth extinction, the countless species we are losing year by year, the melting of the polar ice caps, the climate change, the flooding of entire island nations that is now occurring, and so forth. So, there's the, it's at that level, it's at the civilizational level, the Eurocentric bias that's been awakened by our post-colonial, post-modern awareness. So just as deep ecology has helped awaken us to the anthropocentric bias, so has the post-colonial multicultural awareness of our era awakened us to the Eurocentric bias. And then there's patriarchy, the enormous suffering that has been caused by men acting consciously or unconsciously, usually unconsciously, and the effect on young girls and growing up and their self-images. There's part of the spiritual journey as individuals that I think every one of us in this room recognizes, that there is a certain important quality of emotion that involves mourning, grieving, and remorse that is now needing to be assimilated by the collective. It's each of us as individuals, but also on the collective level. I could talk, you know, in other ways too. Christianity and its shadow, monotheism, religion itself, but science too and its shadow. Science, technology, the objectification of the world that's built into the mainstream scientific paradigm. Commerce, business, corporate, objectifying exploitation of human beings as well as of the rest of nature, of non-human nature. So in all these ways we can see, I think, the truth of something that Octavio Paz, P-A-Z, the Mexican poet, said, of all places, on the front pages of the New York Times Book Review some 20-some years ago. He said, the most powerful remedy for all the ills that face our civilization has been and will continue to be the examination of conscience and the remorse that accompanies it, which is a, as he put it, as a Mexican Catholic background, he said, which is a legacy of Christianity. I'd say it's a legacy of Christianity, Judaism, in some sense it's in all the great axial religions, but that examination of conscience and the remorse that accompanies it is the most powerful remedy for all the ills that face our civilization. So there's something about facing the shadow that's very, very crucial to this transformation. Jung pointed to this when he, in a letter, said, as he sometimes did in letters, he would just be very unguarded and more, even more eloquent because he was being more unguarded and precise. He was talking about male psychology, but he said as he often did, he didn't specify that's what he was talking about, as if it was all psychology. But what he said is, if the apprentice piece of psychological development is the encounter with the shadow, the masterpiece is the encounter with the anima. And another way of putting that in the kind of terms that I'm now talking about at the collective level, because he was talking about the individual level, essential to this initiatory transformation is that examination of conscience, that remorse, that grieving, that recognition of our shadow and the integration of it, the humbling that comes with it. And that, in turn, is part of a larger process that also involves the encounter with the anima, which, if we recognize the deeper collective level of that, that's the anima mundi. It's the soul of the world itself that we need to reconnect to, embrace, conjoin with, co-creatively come into intimate relationship with and participation with. And that involves taking this tremendous evolutionary process that we have been involved in historically for thousands of years, of this painstaking differentiation of consciousness we can see it going all the way back to the certainly to the evolution of the vertebrate brain. I'll say more about that in a second, because one could say that the Cartesian Newtonian mind is the apotheosis of the vertebrate brain. I'll spell that out in just a second. But this tremendous long evolutionary process, which didn't just start with Descartes. Descartes, more like, not only was he expressing a more kind of collective historical emergence of a kind of consciousness in the 17th century, but he was also expressing and enacting an evolutionary process that had been in process for millennia, for millions of years, really. I mean, the more we study mammalian evolution, and then vertebrate evolution, and then even the evolution of life itself, you can see tremendous continuity in this long process of differentiating and empowering a nexus of discernment and volition, of mind and will, of nerve tissues and muscle tissues in the animal organism that becomes more and more differentiated, complexified, magnified, substantiated, empowered, elevated, until you get to this hyper-autonomous, powerful species, Homo sapiens, that is single-handedly, supposedly the most brilliant species the Earth has ever seen, and the most brilliant form of that species, modern civilization, and it's succeeding in so botching up the planetary biosphere that it's collapsing the Cenozoic era. That paradox is what we have to, probably all of us in this room, kind of are basically living with and engaging that paradox day by day. And to see that what is necessary is a kind of radical deconstruction of that that hyper-separated identity, and yet preserving this tremendous evolutionary development in a certain way, and yet also transcending it. I mentioned the decentering and dethroning of that's involved in the postmodern sensibility. That was nicely summarized by Freud in one famous passage from the introductory lectures on psychoanalysis, where he said, there were three great wounding blows to, as he put it in German, man's megalomania and naive self-love, and those three wounding blows were the Copernican Revolution, decentering the Earth and therefore humanity from the cosmic, from the cosmos, its assumed role at the center of the universe, and then Darwin was the second. He mentioned Darwin and Wallace quite accurately. The decentering and dethronement as a species, not the divine center of all of creation, but one more ephemeral species, fallible, and having evolved from our shared ancestors with the chimpanzees and the rest of the primate kingdom. And then the third wounding blow, you can see a little egoism in Freud here, was psychoanalysis. But he had a point, and that was depth psychology, if we expand psychoanalysis to that term that encompasses Jung, William James, Tony Wolfe, Sabina Spielrein, Marion Woodman, James Hillman, Stan Grof, transpersonal psychology, archetypal psychology, the much larger depth psychology phenomenon that has been one of the richest fruits of the marriage of the Enlightenment rational modern mind and the romantic, that is Romanticism's legacy coming from Goethe and Rousseau and Beethoven and so forth, Emerson, right up to the 60s counterculture that focused on the soul side instead of the mind side, the that part of us that is capable of that is more focused on the imagination, on the emotion, on our spiritual intuitions of deeper dimensions of reality, or of a numinous dimension of nature and the cosmos. That romanticism is a very important part of the modern sensibility. It's been englobed by the scientific, natural science reductionist cosmos, that cosmology that is disenchanted. So you've got the romantic soul inside the disenchanted cosmos, and we also are all dealing with that paradox and contradiction, which I kind of spelled out a bit, I think, in the epilogue there, A Passion of the Western Mind. Well, depth psychology is kind of the fruit of that, the solar enlightenment and the lunar romanticism, and brought forth this very rich dispensation, as it's been called. But part of that dispensation was, as Freud put it, the dethronement of the rational ego, which realized that it was not master of its own house, that it was just an epiphenomenon of the instincts of the id, and a very tiny part of it, and it could easily be overruled, civilization and its discontents and so forth. So that's one way of framing that dethronement and so forth. But the dethronement of the human being that has been unfolding in the course of the later modern and postmodern period has taken many, many forms, which we could spell out in another talk. Nietzsche put it quite well when he said, "It's as if modern humanity, ever since Copernicus, has been on an inclined plane, going out into the directionless chaos of the cosmos, with how do you put it, a tremendous will to self-belittlement." Now, what I'd like to posit about that will to self-belittlement is that there's many things going on behind it, many, many motives, such as the rationalist who loves to secretly feel the superiority over all those other cultures and religions that thought that human beings were something special. Of course, the person who's saying that feels quite special that they are recognized that humanity is nothing special, and so there's all sorts of unconscious factors. But one big one that is, I don't think, very often pointed to, but I would like to point out as relevant to what we're talking about tonight, which is that will to self-belittlement, all those ways in which the human being has been dethroned from its cosmic status, even dethroned since the modern mind and modern man's sense of confident progress, civilizational progress, onward and upward, that was going to go on forever just through the systematic development of human reason. That tremendous confidence that the modern civilizational project had, that's been that dethronement, that belittlement, so apparent to us today in the ecological crisis, if nowhere else, where our own rationality has got us into such deep water. We can't help but see the shadow of our own project. All that, I think, that will to self-belittlement, that inclined plane, that free-falling, to use the song by Tom Petty, great song. He captures that kind of postmodern angst of just free-falling. It's both free, the autonomy, and it's falling. All that, I think, reflects this deeper initiatory process, that going down, that descent that has to happen for the transformation to take place. It's a descent into the unconscious. That's what depth psychology has brought about. It's a descent into the deep cosmos, which our cosmological discoveries are are illuminating. It's a descent, a fall, really, from our old modern progress confidence, the descent from the Eurocentric, anthropocentric, patriarchal assumptions and biases and false superiority. So I'm wanting to save the phenomenon of that will to self-belittlement as actually serving a deeper purpose. It's part of an collective unconscious impulse to deflate from the inflation, so that it's part of the night sea journey that has to happen. We have to go down into the depths and be radically humbled. To grasp a little better this parallel, we need history. Randy mentioned that at the beginning about the importance of being able to glimpse that larger arc of the history of Western thought. Not because the West is the best. Not because Western civilization is civilization as it used to think it was. Per se, not because it's the only civilization worth paying attention to, exactly the opposite. We have to pay attention to Western civilization and Western culture's evolution and its history of ideas, because there is no part of the planet and no individual living or coming in these next generations who or which is not being profoundly affected by the assumptions and principles that have driven the Western civilizational project. We have to understand the West, and we have to understand modernity, because there is no island in the South Pacific or iceberg in the North or South Poles that is not directly undergoing consequences of modernity's cosmology, its understanding of the world, its objectification of nature, conviction that about the nature of the human being. So, to see this larger evolutionary logic, we need history. Daniel Boorstein put it. Trying to create the future without knowing history is like trying to plant cut flowers. But we also need to know our history and know the bigger history beyond just the West, because we need to recover and retrieve crucial insights that were available to earlier eras or to other cultures, but that have been eclipsed by the bright light of the modern mind, that have been marginalized and put into the shadow and suppressed. So the act of historical self-understanding is partly a diagnosis. It's partly a kind of etiology in the psychoanalytic sense. But it's also an act of retrieval, because there are moral and spiritual and philosophical and experiential resources and treasures that indigenous tribes and Asian religions and other animals have that we, and plants, that we need. And I believe part of our, this kind of postmodern great turning that we are going through, it's a kind of great turning at the bottom of the great spiral. Part of that great turning involves a profound opening to the wisdom of other sources of insight than those we have largely exclusively focused our energies on. Let me introduce one other concept, and that is the idea of the possibility that we might be entering a second axial era. Now, how many of you here are familiar with the idea of the axial, the first axial era or the axial era? A few. Okay, so I'll, and this term was first used by Carl Jaspers and then has been picked up by many historians of culture and of religion, of philosophy, etc. There's been some wonderful conferences about it and so forth. The axial era was basically in the first millennium BCE, but particularly centered in the 6th century BCE, when simultaneously across much of the world, there was a sudden awakening to a new experience of the nature of reality that involved there being an insight into a transcendent dimension of existence that transcended this world in a certain way, the body, the archaic imperial state, which used to be identified with the divine, the pharaoh at the top, the divine king, etc. But now, in Israel, in Greece, in China, in India, instead of there being the widespread archaic civilizational conviction that the divine was mediated to the rest of humanity by the pharaoh or by the king who had a unique relationship with the divine or was the divine himself, the god king, and at the top of the pyramid. And suddenly there was this disclosure. I mean, really, this happened in a matter of decades that the Buddha and the beginning of Greek philosophy, the beginning of Taoism, Confucianism, Pythagoras, Thales, the great Hebrew prophets, Ezekiel and Second Isaiah, all of whom pointed to Mahavira in India, as well as Gautama Buddha, possibly Zarathustra, though we don't know exactly the century that Zarathustra in Persia was living, but a lot of scholars think it was right then as well. But they all experienced a new way of understanding the nature of reality in which there was one sovereign truth which relativized every other opinion or illusion or maya or shadow. There was the cave of shadows that Plato talked about, and then there was the true archetypal light where the philosopher who'd been illuminated had a glimpse of reality, the archetypal reality with a capital R. And from that position, he or she, and Plato was a proto-feminist in that way, could recognize that what the current government was saying was good and just was not necessarily good and just, but that there was a spiritual, timeless principle of the good, capital G, that you could judge what was being called the good in this world, or justice, or beauty. There are many, many beautiful things in this world, but beauty comes and goes. The beautiful flower emerges, and then it wilts. But there is an archetypal idea of the beautiful, with a capital B, as it were, that all beautiful things and persons and experiences participate in and are informed by, with the Jewish prophets saying, "Yes, you're powerful, King, and you're saying what you say is just, but there is a King of Kings that I have access to, by which I can judge your actions by a higher level of moral value." So in India, it was the mystic. In China, it was the sage. In Israel, it was the prophet. And in Greece, it was the philosopher. And in all of these axial transitions, it's called axial because this turning point, as it were, of human civilization brought about the beginnings of the world religions as we know them. Like Judaism was there before, but it became the way we know it now in that period. The beginnings of philosophy in Greece as well as in India, and so forth, Buddhism, and right across the board, just a tremendous revolution of consciousness. And what it did was it democratized the access to the divine, to the spiritual, that had previously been held by the supreme leader in this state. And the state was divinized, and the state and the cosmos and the divine were all one. It's Eric Vogelin calls it the compact cosmology. And the axial age brought about this differentiation between this higher spiritual dimension that was the ultimate locus of value and meaning and purpose. And it, from this world, and it gave a leverage for transformation of the self and of the social political conditions, because those social political conditions were now seen as secular and not necessarily God's will. And the authority to be able to judge it did not come from the socially sanctioned, politically powerful. Okay, so the problem with that axial transition was that there was a kind of radical differentiation that took place between above and below, between spirit and matter, between heaven and earth. It also got intermingled with a radical separation between male and female. Spirit, mind, the one over nature, matter, the many, the changing. It's like the changeless over the change, the eternal over time, etc. And so there was a shadow dimension to this great axial transformation that gradually gradually evolved. I want to be conscious of my... There's no clocks here, so let me just see. So we started about 10 after... So, okay. Our plan is to, after I set out a few more ideas here, and then to... Randy will come up and we'll break up into small groups for a short while and then come back together again to discuss as a group, Q&A, and so forth. So Let me give you an example of that way in which the patriarchal male-female, masculine-feminine hierarchy, polarization that happened, it got interlinked with this axial transcendence. That's why, you know, you see it in, even in Buddhism, in Hinduism, Judaism. For all the tremendous moral, spiritual development, evolution that happened in all of them, Christianity, Islam, in varying ways, patriarchy runs right through them all. You know, there's self-corrective impulses at work in all of them as well. That's part of the self-transcending moral development that is part of the axial gift. But that shadow is there. And let me give you an example of that. Billy Graham, probably the most well-known and influential Protestant preacher, spiritual leader of the in America of the 20th century. One day I happened to see the news in the early 1990s. I hadn't had any television in my life for about almost 20 years because I love living in Big Sur, where television signals didn't reach over the mountains there to the coast. Had its advantages. I could never have written Passion of the Western Mind if I hadn't been in that cocoon, basically. But when we came so that my children could start being able to be in more in schools and communities and so forth, we moved into Carmel Valley and we got television. One of the very first things I remember seeing was Václav Havel suddenly becoming president of Czechoslovakia, which, you know, was just this miracle. As 1990, late 89, right after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the Velvet Revolution. But a little while after that, I was watching the news, and a hurricane had come through the Carolinas, and Billy Graham was consoling a community there for its great loss, its losses of its homes, its churches, its way of life suddenly had been, you know, destroyed by the hurricane. And he said, if we do not have faith in God the Father, we are going to be at the mercy of Mother Nature. See, by the way, see the disadvantage. I was talking to some of the students and alumni earlier of essentializing the feminine as being, you know, either nature and feeling or intuition or, you know, relationality, et cetera, and the masculine as being, you know, rationality and autonomous will and so forth. We know what is being got at by that, but then there's a big price that is paid if you start identifying Mother Nature and God the Father, which is a dominant mythos that has shaped our civilizational unconscious for centuries and centuries. I think giving you a little bit of a sense, not that you needed to hear this from me, but I'm trying to highlight by these last few remarks how much the axial, and then the modern development of the axial, where the human being became all the more autonomous in some sense, that special relationship that man had being made in the image of God, then gets, once God dies, with the tremendous empowerment of the secular intellect in the course of the modern period, then man is at the top of the pyramid. It's the ultimate source of intelligence in the cosmos, of the known cosmos. And as that summum bonum, there's a obvious hubris and inflation. And that, at the same time, and this is what I was also trying to emphasize, how precious that autonomy is to us, how precious this capacity to, that each of us has as individuals has to find our own way to that divine center in us. That might be one way of putting it. How precious it is for us to not necessarily swallow hook, line, and sinker what the community is, what the community told us when we were growing up, or our parents, or our governing social paradigm, but to think for ourselves. So that autonomy is precious, and yet it has in some sense been purchased at the price of an alienation from the whole. And that tension of opposites is very much something in the Jungian sense that we're having to bear in order to bring forth that transcendent third that emerges when in the fullness of time, not through any decisive act of the ego's will, but rather through a mysterious process of interior exploration, our personal will, but also, could we call it grace? Could we call it the larger telos of the cosmos working through life and evolution in our own individual lives, but also our own collective lives? And don't we think each of us in this room who might have a sense that there's something about our individual lives that doesn't seem to be totally random? Like, it doesn't seem to have been completely accidental that we met this person at this time, or that these doors opened, or that that book came into my field at a certain point, and these ideas opened up my consciousness in a certain way, and then my life unfolded because of that relationship or because of that insight in ways that I wouldn't be able to make sense of my life in any other way. And we have a sense that there's almost a kind of benign artistry at work in our lives as individuals. I think many of us get that sense at a certain point, usually often accompanied by plenty of periods of profound doubt about ourselves and doubt about life and the cosmos itself. But it seems very characteristic of many people's individual journeys that they receive at a certain point a deep conviction that some other larger spiritual intentionality is at work in our lives. Jung called it the self archetype with a capital S. Nice way of getting around sounding too religious. If that is true for ourselves as individuals, why would the divine stop there? Why would the inspirited cosmos just be interested in individuals, but not be interested in the fate of the earth or in the collective? Not that great losses and tragedies and death are not part of the whole. Indeed, they are, all the way. But when has a death not been part of a rebirth? When has a loss not been ultimately the seed of some larger fruitful unfolding that could not have happened in any other way? That kind of spiritual or perhaps even mystical intuition, I think, must be valid personally. And this is my mythos personally, but I know it's not mine alone, is, I believe, also relevant for the understanding our history, understanding the collective development. Now, let me do a very quick, the board is here for a purpose. Some of you who have been in a lecture, when I've come up here other times, have seen this kind of, this mandalic spiral of the evolution of worldviews.
Before. So here is the, I want to first differentiate the modern and the primal worldviews. Just, these will just be headlines. You guys are all so smart and well-informed, I won't have to do much. So the primal worldview has a kind of permeable self in the world. So this is the world, the worldview, the whole, and then the human self has a permeable embeddedness in the whole. And these diagonal lines represent where spirit and soul exist,
where conscious intelligence and purpose and value exist.
In the modern worldview, particularly from Descartes and Bacon and Locke and so forth onwards, first of all, it's a highly differentiated self, and all conscious intelligence and purpose are experienced as residing in the human being, and the rest of the world is an object. So we are subjects in a world of objects. This is much more the state, this primal worldview is much more the state of participation mystique, that the self participates in the inner life of nature. The inner life of nature participates in the human being, and the divine saturates the whole thing. And particularly in the, as we know from studies of the Aboriginal experience, it's very much associated with the land and what we call ubiety, that is, the place is saturated with meaning, with stories, with divinity, and there's much less of a sense of separation between the tribe and the land, the animals, the plants, etc. Not only that, in ritual states, one can enter into the experience of animals, of plants. There is a kind of like what's called the pre-human flux in the Navajo tradition that one accesses in the dream time. Okay, and then you can see in this way that from here to here has been this enormous
evolutionary process over thousands of years that has essentially differentiated the human self, the subject, out of the whole, and that the entire anima mundi, the soul of the world, has been in some way kind of vacuum, like a vacuum cleaner, pulled it into the human being, and only human beings have it. Like we're it, and the world is a world of objects that we can exploit for our own benefit.
In between was the great axial revolution, where the ultimate locus of value and purpose and intelligence and meaning was in a transcendent dimension. But the human being in the earth below, like heaven and earth, or Maya and Brahman, etc., had a special relationship to God or to the divine, different from the rest of nature.
Okay, and that helps prepare for this tremendous empowerment of the human. And then, like with the Renaissance and the Reformation, scientific revolution, there's this tremendous, almost like download of the descent of the divine into the human. You see it in Michelangelo's God on the Sistine Chapel, God touching Adam, and that moment of touching. That's the moment, right at that moment, the Copernican revolution is happening. Copernicus and Kepler and Galileo are getting the download of the scientifically expanded cosmos, and getting and the tremendous confidence that the modern mind received from that sense of, like, for the first time, we understand the structure of the cosmos. The Earth is moving. Nobody believed that before, and now a whole civilization recognizes that the Earth is moving, so we clearly have the most superior mindset ever. Okay, and in a sense, there was this kind of...
I'm tremendously compacting a larger exposition, but there was a kind of download, as it were, of the human being
becoming the locus of that highest form of intelligence, purpose, and value. And there's where the inflation can come as well. And particularly after, as modernity develops and the divine ceases to have that imminent intimacy that for many people, particularly in the more hyper-rational executive ego, then you get the famous declaration of the death of God and the beginning of a whole nother, and what we could now see the beginning of the postmodern movement, which I outlined at the beginning of this talk,
which you can see now is a kind of descent, a kind of fall to the, let's see, I don't see an eraser, but if you could imagine that now this is the very tiny human being in the decentered Earth
and solar system and galaxy that's one amongst billions and billions and billions, and that we are just a meaning-seeking speck of dust in a vast cosmic void. As Nietzsche said, who gave us a sponge to wipe away the entire horizon that held us? Is there still any up or down? Is not night closing in on us, etc.? Okay, but part of the postmodern is not only that decentering and dethronement and all the things that I was describing at the beginning of this talk, the recognition of the shadow, the descent into the deep psyche, the unconscious, the encounter with the depths, the mortality, etc. But there's also intimations of a new intimations that a spiritual dimension does exist. It happens as people do their private wilderness journeys, or where they have an LSD session, or where they have a spontaneous awakening to the numinous dimension of life. It can take so many different forms. And there's also the recognition, part of postmodernity is recognizing that our reality is interpretive, that we are partially, deeply creating our reality by the assumptions and principles with which we approach it.
And so there's we look out and act out in the world, and then that in turn feeds back to us in a kind of recursive loop,
so that we're in a kind of act of world creation at the same time that the world is creating us. It's a recursive loop, so that then we have a kind of moral and epistemological responsibility in being co-creators of the world we live in. So part of postmodernity in its earlier stages in particular is a sense of profound disorientation and uncertainty and groping. But then another part of it is this sense of joyful taking of responsibility that we are the cosmos in human form, playing a crucial creative, co-creative role in the unfolding of the whole. And that's one of the many nobilities of the postmodern era, The postmodern era is...
I put it down here. In many ways, it's the opposite of the axial, because it's also a descent into the underworld, into the taboo. It's also a recovery of the
feminine, if we can hold that lightly, from the patriarchal side of the axial. It's a descent into recognition of our embeddedness in biological evolution, in our kinship with all the other animals and plants and life and the earth community, etc. And then there's a great uncertainty.
So there's these intimations of spiritual meaning. It's not all a disenchanted cosmos, this void. There's intimations of spiritual meaning, but there's also a big question mark that's part of
the postmodern. There's a sense of uncertainty. And if you think about the nature of an initiation, uncertainty is essential to it. If you know that it's all going to work out perfectly, there's no power to the transformation. You can't have a pretend near-death experience for it to work. It doesn't have the existential impact. It can't. You have to be uncertain about the result, and there has to be, everything has to be at stake as it is, as we are experiencing it today. It's very much part of the initiatory process. And what I believe is happening, I used to, when I was describing these different worldviews,
put this postmodern over here in a kind of like fourth place. And then I realized this is the part of the of a spiral at where we
have this possibility. It's not just a circle of we need to recover the primal, but we don't just decimate the development of this differentiated, morally responsible, intellectually autonomous, relationally differentiated self. We need to simultaneously preserve and transcend it and come into relationship to the whole, to the anima mundi, etc. And so I'll just say a couple more words here about the second axial era and then Q&A. But Ewart Cousins was a Fordham philosopher who came up with the idea of, and in a sense, not the idea, but the intuition of an emerging second axial era. He was particularly focused on, you know, the ecumenical developments of coming out of the 60s. He was, by the way, a close friend and colleague of Thomas Berry. They taught together there and influenced each other. Anyway, he's both dealing with, you know, interreligious dialogue and ecumenism, but also with the ecological crisis. And he said, the consciousness of the 21st century will be global from two perspectives. And this is how he was defining the possibility of a second axial era. Compared with the first axial era, which had, you know, Judaism and Buddhism and Christianity and Hinduism and so forth, all developing in their own particular ways, highly evolved and differentiated ethical, philosophical, religious structures and qualities apart from each other. And he said, now the consciousness of the 21st century will be global from two perspectives. One from a horizontal perspective. The cultures and religions are meeting each other on the surface of the globe, entering into creative encounters that will produce a complexified collective consciousness. I think probably every one of us feels that here, how much, I mean, sometimes when I have to sign a a form that says, what religion am I? I'll put down Hindu, Buddhist, Jewish, Taoist, shamanic, goddess religion, you know, et cetera. Because they're all true. I mean, I feel deeply identified with, not just sympathetic to, but I can see through those eyes, and I feel they are living gifts. Anyway, that's would happen. And then he says, from a vertical perspective, they must plunge their roots deep into the earth in order to provide a stable and secure base for future development. So there's a vertical dimension into the earth. This is partly that depth dimension, the going into the depths of the earth, the depths of the cosmos, instead of being the focus all up on the spirit of the axial or on man. See, what I'm describing here is we could call it a cosmotheanthropic imagination at work. Cosmos, theos, anthropos. Cosmotheanthropic picks up on a term that Raymond Panikkar, one of my teachers at Harvard, but he was a kind of Catholic Hindu Spanish philosopher, died recently. And he's called it cosmotheandric. I don't know why he said theandric. Andric refers in Greek to men. Anyway, so that's why I say at least cosmotheanthropic to include more obviously all humans. But this is also the realm of the imagination and also of the earth. So it's all four are evolving right now. It's a huge kind of project of the animus mundi. And so when he said, from a vertical perspective, they must plunge their roots deep into the earth to provide a stable and secure base for future development. This new global consciousness must be organically ecological, supported by structures that will ensure justice and peace. In the second axial period, this twofold global consciousness is not only a creative possibility to enhance the 21st century, it is an absolute necessity if we are to survive. I would add that the vertical opening must also be not only deep downwards into the earth, but also deep inwards into the psyche. That's an essential part of the transformation. Of the great turning, and also deep outwards into the cosmos to provide a more encompassing cosmic context for humanity's spiritual aspirations and self-knowledge. That's a whole other part of my work. Like into the soul of the cosmos, which is our own soul. But if we, there's one more thing I want to add about that second axial age, and that is if we understand how the first axial age brought about that democratization of the access to the divine from the top of the pyramid that the pharaoh or the king or the top of the hierarchy had either the exclusive access to the divine and then mediated it through grand ritual, etc., to the rest of the... And this was all unquestioned. That numinosity that collects around the higher parts of like the aristocracy or the royalty, you still have it like in England. There's still like a kind of numinosity around the royal family, even though it's been totally all too humanized. There's a numinosity there. If you, those of you who watch Downton Abbey, that you're seeing at work there in the first half of the 20th century, this dissolution or deconstruction of that old archaic hierarchy where there's a kind of numinosity that surrounds the upper class, which comes from this earlier
archaic stage in between here and here, where there was this pyramid of spiritual dignity with the divine at the top, etc. Anyway, that's a whole nother lecture.
But my main point with respect to the second axial era is what I believe now is required is a radical democratization of spiritual dignity to all beings. It was a big step to give it to all human beings in principle that the axial did, though it was very tended towards both the patriarchal and also towards its own religion in exclusivist ways. But it still broke through out of the compact cosmology of the archaic civilizations. But we need a radical democratization of spiritual dignity to all beings, which I think is spontaneously emerging in many of our lives and sensibility. And I'll just finish by quoting Thomas Berry, a quote that is on the bottom of any email you might happen to get from Randy, because Randy includes it. But this is, when I read it, I thought, what a perfect description of this democratization of spiritual dignity to all beings, to the cosmos and all its manifestations. This is Thomas Berry from The Dream of the Earth. Interior articulation of its own reality is the immediate responsibility of every being. Every being has its own interior, its self, its mystery, its numinous aspect. To deprive any being of this sacred quality is to disrupt the larger order of the universe. Reverence will be total, or it will not be at all. Now, Thomas is not gesturing towards the way I have wanted to tonight, the degree to which not only is this numinosity to be restored to the whole, but also I believe, in order to be true and faithful to the whole, we have to be true also to our own history and to the fact that the cosmos has evolved through us in a particular way that puts us at a particular time of moral and spiritual transformation that our rite of passage is now putting us through the crucial threshold for, so that it's not just a matter of going back to the primal. It's entering back into the relationship to the whole, but in a sacred marriage, as it were, of the solar and the lunar, the heroic solar journey, returning into the co-creative marriage with the whole. Okay, that's all I'll say for now, and then we'll please come up, Randy, and we'll go from there.
And that is the end of part one. There's another 45 minutes of Q&A in a separate file. All rights reserved. No copying, please.